Just about everywhere you look in Europe, leaders are falling and nations are struggling to replace them. Germany, France, Austria, Spain, Belgium, Romania are all having serious leadership issues right now. What is next for leaderless Europe? Let's find out on today's Trumpet World. Some of Europe's most important countries are missing their leaders right now. Governments are falling. You've got what you could call zombie governments, governments that have lost all power and life but continue to trudge on. Or you've got countries where they've had elections and they can't figure out a new government. Now, coalition governments and troubles regarding coalition governments are a fact of life in European politics. And in a union of 27 different nations, you are going to have coalition negotiations and falling governments somewhere. But I don't think I can remember a time when there's been such a massive leadership vacuum that is just so widespread. So I'm joined today by Josué Michels, and we're going to discuss it all. So Josué, let's start with Germany. Their government lost its vote of no confidence on Monday. That wasn't a surprise. That was kind of a scheduled vote, but officially, the government is over. The starting gun has been fired for elections. What is the state of play there?
Yes, that's right. And that's quite a historic moment for Germany. We remember the Weimar Republic, where there was just one government after one government, and it was a failure that led to the rise of Adolf Hitler. So after World War II, Germany made some strict laws to make sure that they have a stable government. And in the course of the next few decades, they pretty much had long-running governments that, for some people, that ruled more than 10 years. Angela Merkel ruled more than many people wanted in Germany, and it was hard to get a different leader in there if someone didn't want to step down. Olaf Scholz, he was only in there for about 3 years. So that's very little time for a leader in Germany in that regard. And he also had to leave office, or he's about to leave office, he's still in there right now, after having some trouble with his coalition and in a way losing a vote of confidence, which only happened like 3 times or so in recent decades. So it's very rare for Germany to be in such a predicament as they are in right now. So the very next thing after losing the vote of confidence is that the president of Germany, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, he will have to dissolve parliament, he will have to set the date for the new elections, which they are hoping for February 23rd.
We're in a really odd situation. I think we'll talk about Italy a little bit later, but you know, your point about Germany is used to stability. This used to be a big thing where you'd compare the number of prime ministers that Italy has had to the number of chancellors Germany's had. And it seemed like Italy would get a new government every few months while Germany would keep their chancellors for about a decade. And now they're in this position where they're having these early elections. So this is something that Germany very much isn't used to. Even the constitution is kind of written to try and prevent a quick cycle of governments. We've also kind of been stuck in this for a while now in Germany. I think it was not the last election, but the one before. It took them 6 months to agree a coalition negotiation. This coalition is 3 different parties, but crucially, it's not 3 parties that are used to working together. You kind of have some parties that are, they kind of always work in coalition, and it's not really any trouble. This is, you've got, well, the Greens that want environmental spending, the Social Democrats that want social spending, and then you've got the Free Democrats that kind of want no spending. In some ways, it's almost surprising they've made it this far. There've been so much arguing. So that's fallen apart, and I think the other thing that is interesting in the run-up to this election is that kind of fundamental situation of awkward coalitions and things like that doesn't seem to show any signs of ending anytime soon.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. So Angela Merkel, she had that grand coalition between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, which have been for decades the largest party. But then you had the Green Party pop up and you have other smaller parties come up. Most recently, the far-right party, as they call it, the Alternative for Deutschland, which is more conservative, who actually broke away from the Christian Democratic Union because they weren't conservative enough anymore. And they have some very fringe views in there. Then you have another one that broke up just from the left party, so the parliament is separating more and more, so common strategies of forming coalitions are getting harder and harder. And also, yes, the next election, they were saying, like, if the FDP, the Free Democrats, are making it in the parliament, what kind of coalition are you going to have? You probably will have to have one with the Christian Democratic Party forming a coalition, probably with the Green Party, which is in government right now, and with the Free Democrats, which are in government right now. So you're only getting rid of the Social Democrats and you're still in a three-party coalition there. And it actually is quite interesting, if that comes up in the end, they could actually form a government like that much earlier. Because right now, these three parties, they have a majority in parliament. So if they agree on, for example, saying, we want a vote of no confidence, now Scholz, he's able to make a vote of confidence, and he lost that right now. But he will be in this position till February. Now these other parties could say, hey, there is a way to get a chancellor in earlier, because we have a few crises, and I saw a few articles, they're a little bit more fringe, they talked about this. They're saying there's a lot of talk about this, it's underground a little bit, and Merz actually said he doesn't like that idea too much, but he didn't say absolutely no to it. So what he could do is rally those other parties behind him, the Greens and the Free Democrats, and do a vote of no confidence in Scholz, which would force him to step down and replace him with Merz. So if they are seeing that the election is turning out where they anyways have to form a coalition like that, they could decide, well, we have that majority already, why risk the far right gaining more? Why have Scholz in power till February? Why not end it right now in January and get a leader in there before Donald Trump comes in, before there's an agreement in dividing Ukraine in one way or another? So there are some speculations about that. Again, Merz said that he didn't see that as a possibility earlier, but circumstances might change, and that's a legal procedure to get rid of Scholz much earlier.
If they did that, there'd be no election? Or is there a possibility that they could do that and have an election still and guess and just get rid of Scholz, get rid of the out of this kind of as out of the caretaker role?
So Scholz would be removed, but then this national election would have to take place in September for sure. So maybe they can get rid of the new elections, that they would have to work with the president in that way. And then there are like emergency rules where you can suspend elections, but that's a little bit of a stretch there.
So basically there are complicated shenanigans where you could see that coalition come to power without election, which is an interesting point because it doesn't really look like things are fundamentally going to change all that much after there's elections. I mean, the Social Democrats are no longer going to be the biggest party. And the big change that at least polls forecast right now, and we're still 2 months out from February 23rd, which is the date they've at least penciled in for the elections, polls indicate that the Alternative for Deutschland will be the number two party, that they would have a significant increase. They would have a one-fifth of all seats in the Bundestag, in the German parliament. And the big problem here, you know, like you're saying, everyone says we're not going to work with the AfD. And then there's the Sarah Wagenknecht Bundes, like her party, this offshoot of the left party, that a lot of groups say we're not going to work with her either. Well, fine, but now you're trying to form a coalition at 50% using only 75% of the seats. And that is really hard to do. So yeah, this is not kind of a one-off part crisis and then it is fixed as long as everyone settles on everything on the election, and that election is going to solve everything. So it is interesting to hear people are trying to even think of ways to fix it even ahead of the elections.
Yes, and it's a little bit complicated and messy, but we do expect people diverge from the Democratic vote, because people don't like how people vote these days, and they try to circumvent that vote more and more often. And Mr. Flue has said that a strong leader could come in through a weak coalition, and he would not come in through votes. So this would be a way for the parliamentarians, the leaders, to appoint a new leader without the vote of the people. So we may see something like that, we may not. But it is interesting that people are talking about it because of the crisis in politics and because of the global crisis in general, where they're saying we need a strong leader now.
I think it is worth taking a couple of minutes to talk about that prophecy, probably even right now, because it is so central to everything that we are watching. So Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 are two passages that we turn to very commonly to talk about European politics. And in both of these chapters, you have prophecy that Daniel wrote that ended up being fulfilled in part or in type anciently in a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. And just about all of the different Bible kelps and things that you'll read will say this passage matches Antiochus Epiphanes. So much so that people trying to reject the Bible will claim that the book of Daniel is a forgery and that these passages were written after the life of Antiochus Epiphanes because they so closely match his life and his time in office, his reign, where he was ruling in this Seleucid kingdom in Syria and the Middle East. So they will they'll say it's all a forgery because they cannot accept the idea that Daniel describes such a man so accurately 200 or 300 years in advance. But Daniel also says, well, actually, the main focus of my prophecy is for this end time. And if you turn to things that Jesus Christ himself said in Matthew 24, in the parallel passage in Luke, I think that might be Luke 21, he says, he goes to some of those same passages that talk about this same Antiochus, and he says, well, watch for this thing to happen in the future. And Jesus Christ is writing several hundred years after the life of this Antiochus. So those prophecies that you're getting there, Jesus Christ himself is saying they have a future implication as well, that this ancient Antiochus is not the be-all and end-all of these prophecies. So as Christians, you know, we claim to be followers of Jesus Christ and that we believe the words of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ himself says you need to watch for these prophecies that talk about Antiochus Epiphanes to be fulfilled in the future. So what this tells us is these prophecies that describe this Antiochus Epiphanes, this ancient leader, this ancient Antiochus, he's only a type of a modern leader that is going to come. And you can turn to some of the other passages that I think we'll probably look at a bit later. And you can see from those passages, this is talking about a leader that is going to arise in Europe. Now, Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21 is a passage about this Antiochus Epiphanes. It says, "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." And what this is saying, they won't give him the honor of the kingdom. He'll take it in peaceably by flatteries. If you look at what the original words here mean, it's saying that he doesn't come into office by the regular way. He obtains it by flatteries. He attains it in an irregular, unusual way. And Mr. Flurry has said for years and years that this is that complex coalition negotiations could pave a way for this leader to come in.
Now, he's not going to come in by, let's say, a democratic process. He's going to come in and use flatteries and sort of tweak the democratic process. It says here something like that, and perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. But he's going to come in by flatteries. So God sees him, well, not the same way the people see him, but he actually gains that power, hijacks that European superpower by flatteries. He apparently puts together some kind of a small coalition, and that's how he moves into power. I mean, he is unusually adept at flattery. You have to be very intelligent to be able to deceive people in high places with that, with flattery. And he does it magnificently. Well, he was never voted into the office, but he came in, got control of all that power through deceit and flatteries. Now, remember, this is an end-time book, and this is an end-time prophecy. It's going to happen again in this end time. A man is going to come, and through deceit and flatteries is going to get control of the Holy Roman Empire and its 10 toes or 10 kings, and not by voting. Even though that is their system today, it is not going to, he's going to come in another way.
And his latest article on this is After Trump's Victory, Watch Germany. And that article takes you through exactly what to watch for in this German election and why you will very likely see some of our longest standing prophecies be fulfilled over the next few months. And some very dramatic events in Europe and Germany as they're in this leaderless state. But he talks about, he makes the analogy with Kamala Harris. And I think I found that very helpful in kind of visualizing a practical way of what coming in by flatteries looks like. And he talks about the way that the Democratic Party had united behind Joe Biden. You know, he'd gotten all the delegates. He had got the honor of the kingdom, you could say. You know, he had been appointed leader of the Democratic Party in the regular, the standard way. Okay, though, you know, nobody really ran against him. It wasn't particularly democratic. There are things you could criticize about the process, but that was the typical normal way of choosing a Democratic presidential candidate in terms of accumulating delegates and getting their votes. Suddenly, at the last minute, Democrats decided, we can't have this guy lead our ticket. He's not mentally competent to do that. We need a new leader, and there's not time to go about the regular way of gathering Democrats and holding a vote. And they just kind of, everyone just agreed, or all the people that mattered, really, Barack Obama and those around him, we'll settle on Kamala Harris. And we haven't done it according to the rules laid out in the Democratic Party. We've not done it the way that we've always held votes. We've not given members of the Democratic Party a say like they're supposed to have in choosing the candidate. For whatever reason, because of this kind of unusual circumstances, we're going to parachute Kamala Harris in as leader of the ticket. That is what we could see in Germany very soon. Something where people say, look, there's no time to have the normal elections and lengthy coalition negotiations. We need to make use of some emergency laws. We need to make use of a special circumstance. We need to get a strong man in power. Now, in Mr. Flurry's article, he also talks about an individual that we've been watching as a potential for this strongman for a great many years. And that individual is former German defense minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. And there's a number of different reasons why we're watching this individual. You know, he was once a rising star. He was once kind of in the running to be Angela Merkel's successor. And it looked like he did have a pretty easy route into the chancellorship. He was booted out of the government and resigned in disgrace over a plagiarism scandal back, I think, in 2011. Since then, he has moved to the United States. He's moved back to Germany. He's become a very outspoken German critic of Donald Trump, and that is one of the key reasons why Mr. Flurry is still watching him. So you've been watching what he's been up to with these elections and things like that. Do you have an update of his outlook in the run-up to these elections?
Yes, he is very much on the urgent side, where he's saying that because he's a strong critic of Donald Trump, that Germany and Europe as a whole needs a leader to confront Donald Trump. They need a leader who is able to talk on eye level with him when it comes to tariffs policies. So he's very much saying, like, what Scholz is doing right now is unacceptable. He's not behaving as a leader for that. And he is supporting Friedrich Merz to step it up, and he is urging him to get into office quite quickly.
So is he supporting this idea of Friedrich Merz coming in without an election?
He hasn't said, I don't know.
So it's more of a general step it up right now rather than a specific do this and this and this and this.
Yeah, he has taught him for years that he has to make his desires more known to be a chancellor and to get himself into that office. But the party didn't really want him, and the people, he was not very popular, but over the years he came around it. And now it looks like, at the latest in February, he will have the best shot to be chancellor.
Merz will.
Merz, yeah. Yep. Merz.
Okay, great. And I think it's also worth bringing Austria up at this point. I mean, really, there are bigger, more powerful European nations in turmoil than Austria. Austria isn't one of the giants, the heavyweights. But I think the political trends in Austria and in Germany are obviously pretty similar. They're going through some of the same kind of turmoil. They had their election They had an election on September 29th. In some ways, that election was kind of a culmination of some political chaos with leaders going to jail and scandal and things like that. But they had their election, and the Freedom Party of Austria won that election, which is a massive result. Freedom Party of Austria is kind of their equivalent of the Alternative for Deutschland, though with more historical baggage than the Alternative for Deutschland. This is a party that was founded by a couple of former SS members in 1956. Like a whole lot of these parties within Europe, they have that history. They have kind of disavowed some of their more extreme positions. They have tried to move towards the mainstream in recent years. Generally, the public are divided as to whether they, how they view that DNA and whether they see that change as sufficient to kind of remove that from their DNA. But they won on September 29th. They got 29% of the vote. So they would have needed a coalition. They have worked in coalition before, but this time they would be the dominant party, the leading party. You would expect the prime minister to come from the Freedom Party of Austria. And the mainstream across Austria did not like that at all. And so they're looking at a three-party coalition that includes kind of the mainstream right and the mainstream left, just so they can exclude the Freedom Party of Austria. And the Austrian public had a chance to have their say on that, where they had a state election in Styria. Am I saying that right? Close enough?
I think so.
Styria in late November. The Freedom Party of Austria won 35% of the vote, even more than they won in the national election. The deputy leader said there has been a landslide in Styria. I didn't expect such a resounding result. I think it was only the second time they'd ever come first place in a state election. So the public seemed like they're rallying behind the Freedom Party of Austria while the mainstream tried to exclude them from power. So and obviously we're in December now. They still don't have a government. They're still negotiating. These three parties say, well, we'll think we'll have a government probably sometime in the new year. And again, it's mainstream left, mainstream right, a smaller party cobbled on. I mean, this is kind of Germany's future, unless you have some other means of getting a strong leader in power, don't you think?
Yeah, and it's interesting that fight against democracy here again, the largest party won. And then the Austrian president, Alexander Van der Bellen, he actually said...
Well, the far-right party won.
Yeah, the far-right party won, and the president said, well, I can't give you the right to form a coalition or even enter coalitions. I give it to the second party, the People's Party. They are having the right now to form a coalition. So obviously people see that now this party won our votes and you're giving that party the right to form a coalition, not even giving them a try to form a coalition. No, fair enough, they would have a hard time to form a coalition, that's for sure. But why not even let them give a try? Because they're like, well, that will take too much time. But now you have that three-party coalition that's taking so much time because they can't agree on anything. So yes, and there's actually an interesting case in 2017. The election had it in a very similar way, where the far-right party was about to win the election. And then a strong leader, Sebastian Kurz, the youngest foreign minister of Austria, stepped up and told his party, you make me party leader? Under these and these conditions, I run for election and I save you guys. And then he went into coalition with the far right, but he beat them in the election and he greatly reduced their vote at that election. So you can see how one strong leader can change an election like that, but they don't have that right now. So that's why they have the turmoil.
And this is the decline in democracy in Europe going on at the same time is another important part of this story. Like, you can see it paving the way for Europe, for someone to be brought in by flatteries, where it's not easy. But like, you look at Austria, and if Austria had given the Freedom Party of Austria the chance to form a coalition and they'd gone on to name the prime minister, you know, I think we'd be on the same show and we would be talking about how shocking it is that a former SS part, like a party founded by former SS people, now has the prime minister of Austria and is leading the coalition. So I think we kind of have some sympathy for the president and his decision to to do that and to go to the number two party, but it was against all of those past norms. Romania, we talked about this time last week, where again, I think it's a complicated situation, but where unquestionably in my mind, Russia interfered in that election. But so they then cancelled their entire presidential election. There was another round that was about to take place. They just cancelled that, which, okay, yeah, there was Russian interference, but to just cancel an election and say, you got the answer wrong in the last election, you voted for a far-right pro-Russian guy, nope, try again. And in the meantime, we're going to delay elections. In the meantime, we're going to find some reason to exclude the pro-Russian guy and make sure he can't run again. Like, I would be incredibly surprised if when they redo the election next year, he is allowed to run. I think they will find a way to disqualify him and probably jail him. So in some of these, there are kind of understandable reasons or there's other extenuating circumstances, but even so, democracy in Europe is struggling. And you can see that paving the way for the rise of a strongman and it not being even so unusual anymore for someone to come into power in Germany and flatteries. In the background of what's happened in Austria and against the background in Romania, against the background of kind of France repeatedly trying to use constitutional mechanisms to ram the budget down in a reluctant parliamentary throat, all of these things, I think that won't look as shocking now as it would have done maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah, and the big thing is the voters. They vote for parties they know are not going to make the chancellor or the leader of that country. So they are expecting some kind of different deal. They are voting in rebellion to the mainstream, most of all, not actually expecting a leader from that party. So they are kind of getting accustomed to that idea, like, you do whatever you want anyways, no matter what I vote, so why should I care what you're doing? And I have heard that argument a few times, that they are just, they don't care about democracy anymore because they feel betrayed by it.
Yeah, like a vote for the AfD or a vote for the Freedom Party of Austria, in many ways, it's not a vote for an alternative political party. It's a vote to burn the system down. And I think we can both sympathize with that. Like, yeah, there's a lot about the system that is unjust. And there's a lot about the system that have made catastrophic mistakes. And you think of things like the mass migration of migrants into Europe from the Middle East and from Syria in particular. Like, that is not the result of one political party. That is the result of just about all the mainstream political parties. It's the result of Europe's legal system. It is the result of European treaties. It is the result of the European Commission, the European Court of Justice, United Nations. Like, it's much wider than one party. And so when people vote for the alternative for Deutschland, it's a vote against all of that. And absolutely, we sympathize with that. But at the same time, then, yeah, you're right. It's causing people, and I think the blame is on the mainstream. The blame is on the people that opened the doors to the migrants and said, let it come. The blame is on the people that have reinterpreted international law to make it almost impossible to exclude migrants. People are looking at that and saying, yeah, democracy, it's democracy is a farce. Democracy is always rigged against me. I don't care if democracy ends because it's all a farce anyway. So I think that is a dangerous position to get us into. And the AfD and the Freedom Party of Austria and all these others, they're not the ones that got us into the position. It's Angela Merkel and it's the Christian Democratic Union and the Social Democratic Union. I mean, we were writing 10 years ago that Angela Merkel is playing with fire. And I think that is becoming increasingly obvious.
Yes, and there are certain leaders in the European Union, you can expect them to want to use this crisis, if not even cause this crisis, because they have a history of making a political union they know is going to fail. We have been warning on that for decades too. They knew that this is not able to go along. You can't take those different countries together. You can't take different parties together to bring them all into united government. And many people are upset that the European Union is failing, but it is a bit part of the plan.
And that is interesting. I think the AfD had their platform this week where they officially called for a Gexit, I guess it would be, or a Gerexit, Germany leaving the European Union, a return to the Deutschmark.
Which is quite deceitful because Germany is the one that profits from the European Union the most in some ways, but they're always able to spin it around, like, oh, we are the victims, we are paying for everyone else, so it's a little bit of a...
It's also to return to the roots. I mean, the AfD started as this kind of nerdy anti-Euro party, and then later had other people jump in. But we might come back to some of that. We want to make sure we get to some of these other countries. So France is also big on the list of countries that are in complete disarray, where I guess they gained a head of government this week rather than losing one, but they lost one quite dramatically earlier in December, where they held a censure motion against the Prime Minister Michel Barnier, and he was booted out of office after failing that censure motion. Emmanuel Macron, it seemed like, had a tough time appointing him. People thought maybe he'd have a new candidate in place within the next couple of days. It was like it dragged on a while. He then said, okay, I'll name someone within the next 48 hours. That deadline went and he still hadn't named someone. Finally, he named François Bayrou as Michel Barnier's replacement. The new prime minister faces the same problem as the old, where France held their parliamentary elections, kind of like Germany is about to do, had the inconclusive result that it looks like Germany is about to have, and they're fairly evenly split. You've got kind of a third far left, or pretty close to that, a third in the middle, and then a third far right is the term that tends to be used for the National Rally Party. I mean, some of the things that they do, I think, are almost far left. A lot of these labels are not great, but to keep it simple, far left, center, and far right, they agree on stuff they don't want. I think we all find it pretty similar, easy, I guess, as part of human nature. We agree on we don't like this, and we don't like that, and we don't like this change. They don't really agree on anything they do want, which makes it then really hard for any prime minister. And the top item on the agenda of just about any prime minister is France's debt, where they're borrowing around 6% of the size of their economy each year. It's unsustainable. Their debt, I think, is 110% of their economy. It's a little bit behind the United States, but it's around double Germany's debt level. So they've got, and it's well out of away from EU rules, where they mandate a 3% of your economies, that's all you're allowed to borrow every year. They need to get their debt under control, and they can't, because no prime minister can get a budget through parliament. And they narrowly averted a government shutdown at the end of the year, and a government not even be able to pay taxes and pay its bills by just cycling over last year's budget and just basically copying and pasting it to next year's. The new prime minister wants to then still deal with that and adjust that, but that means you're just still borrowing money at exactly the same rate. So Moody's downgraded French debt from AA2 to AA3. The stat that really strikes me is that France has to pay more to borrow money than Greece does. So investors are looking at Greece and they're looking at France and they're saying, I'd rather lend money to Greece. So they're in quite a tough position. And then, like you said earlier, 1930s, this kind of constant turnover of governments is one of the things that you saw in the run-up to the rise of the Nazis. So France isn't allowed to hold another election for 12 months since the last one. So it's not a problem that's going away anytime soon either.
Yeah, and very much so Emmanuel Macron caused that, because we had a European election and the far right was winning big gains, and he was like, well, let's call new elections here in France, the national elections. And then obviously they gained their two, but then they had a second vote. That's the French system. They had a second vote where they narrowed it down, and then he told some of his party to withdraw if the left were able to win against the far right. So he emboldened the left, which is a very dangerous game, because if you look into that party, they are very anti-American. Almost every left party is very anti-capitalist. But like the far right is anti-American, both sides are anti-American. So he emboldened a big dangerous mixture. And a little bit backfired on him there, and now he's kind of fed up with it, where he's saying, like, well, I want to be now the international president, I want to be the one that makes the peace deal with Lebanon and Israel, I want to travel I want to open Notre Dame and invite President Trump in there. I want to travel to those other regions, and he doesn't want to be involved. And the prime minister is right now upset with him, like, you are traveling all over the world and we have a mess here. So
the left in France is kind of an alliance of a number of parties. But yeah, people like Jean-Luc Mélenchon is pretty extreme. I think it's also interesting that he's pretty extremely anti-German as well. Like, he had his book during the Euro crisis that he wrote that, if he got his way, I think you'd have a Frexit and you'd have France leave the European Union. And he basically threatened, he wanted, his economic policy was to hold Germany to ransom and say France is going to print euros, which would then weaken the German currency unless you give us money and give us what we want. So, like, there's a reason for Germany to be concerned by his rise and what is going on there in France. So that whole thing is becoming a mess. And yeah, like, we've talked about this strongman that is forecast, and the Bible says he's going to come from Germany. I think if you look at Emmanuel Macron, you get the impression he'd kind of like to be Europe's strongman. He would like to be that kind of leader. The Bible says it's not going to happen, and you look at what's happening at home in France, and it's just, you know, they don't have the economic strength, they don't have the political unity. But that economic weakness is kind of huge, where this is leading to potentially another economic crisis. Whenever anything happens in Europe to do with the economy, France can't bail anyone out. They've got to go to Germany. So he would like to be strong, but can't be.
Yeah, and that brings to light a prophecy in Revelation 17, where it talks about the unification of European leaders that Mr. Armstrong has explained. Would be 10 European countries or groups of nations, and they find themselves in such a crisis where, yes, each country wants to do their own thing, but they find themselves in a crisis where they say, we need an overarching leader and we give our power to that leader. And Emmanuel Macron, we don't know if he will make it long, but perhaps he will, and a crisis like that will probably get him more willing to submit to Germany or a German leader that's over the European Union. And he has an unusual love for Germany, which he expressed on many occasions. He also is allied with the Catholic Church in some ways. So he could be a leader where you could say, like, yes, I'm willing to submit to that overarching leader. And another prophecy is that those leaders will be Catholic and they will be uniting. We see that from Revelation 17 as well. So we see that the Catholic Church and the overarching leader are going to be uniting these leaders. And a crisis like that is definitely driving that forward. So that's definitely fulfilled prophecy right there.
And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry had an article in March 2020, France is Resurrecting the Holy Roman Empire, that gets into more detail in France, in prophecy, and the way that that France is empowering Germany. I think, we'll come back to Revelation 17 in just a minute as we talk about how Europe can get out of this leaderless mess. But I think it's worth just giving a quick summary of one or two other countries where Germany, easily the most populous country in Europe, the biggest economy in the European Union, absolutely the leader there, and they're leaderless. Number two, is France. People always talk about this Franco-German engine being right at the heart of Europe. And Emmanuel Macron, like you said, he's done a lot to empower Germany. But they don't have a prime minister. They don't have a united government. That makes it, they still have some strength in Macron, but that makes it very hard for him to play a decisive role on the international scene. Italy is the third largest economy and the third largest in terms of population. They do have a pretty stable government. And I think that is fascinating to look at. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. But then Spain. Spain is the number four. In terms of population and economy, and they're kind of in chaos as well. It's less dramatic because of their political system than some of these other ones. But their Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, he's lost his majority in Parliament, where he kind of ruled with the support of this Catalan separatist party called Junts. I guess it would be Junts, probably, because it's Spanish. But I'm going to say Junts because I'm British. So he ruled with their support. But there's been a lot of disagreement between him and between Junts, and the Spanish judiciary are trying to jail Junts' leadership because they participated in what the judiciary call an illegal referendum in trying to separate Catalonia off from Spain. Anyway, this has brought down, it was never a formal coalition, but Junts has kind of withdrawn their support in Parliament for Sanchez. And now they introduced a motion into Parliament calling on Sanchez to submit to a motion of confidence. And Spain is kind of similar to Germany, where Parliament can't force out the Prime Minister without having an alternative candidate. So they can have a motion of confidence in an alternative. There is no way the Spanish Parliament is going to be able to do that. But unless Sanchez voluntarily comes before Parliament and holds a motion of confidence in his own government, Parliament has no way of pushing him out. Unlike in Germany, he's not keen to do that. And there's less pressure on him to do that. So it seems like Spain, we're kind of looking at this zombie government where he doesn't have a majority in Parliament. Parliament can't force him out, but he can't do anything either. He can't get anything through Parliament. And Spain is just going to keep ticking on with their same old budget, but they're not going to be able to take any big decisions. They're not going to be able to take any major leadership. Theirs is kind of just the appearance of a government, whereas in reality, they're basically on autopilot. So that is Europe's number four country. So three out of the four big countries in Europe are kind of down and out when it comes to leadership. And then Brussels, Belgium. You know, Brussels is kind of the European capital. It's where a lot of the big decisions happen. They haven't had a government for 6 months. Now, Belgium's kind of good at that. They've been a bit of a basket case for a few years now. But they had elections back in June, and they're still trying to form a government. So yeah, that trend is spreading there. The Netherlands, they were in a similar situation to Austria, where Geert Wilders won the election. I do think Geert Wilders, even though he often gets lumped in with people like the Freedom Party of Austria and the Alternative for Deutschland, like I do think he's fundamentally different. His DNA is fundamentally different. He doesn't go back to parties that were founded by SS officers and that kind of thing. But anyway, he won. Nobody wanted to get behind him in a coalition, so he kind of agreed to serve in somebody else's coalition. But even that coalition keeps sputtering, and they almost fell apart over the pogrom in Amsterdam a few weeks ago, where you had Jewish football supporters being chased through the streets. So they're in a precarious situation as well. And I think they're Europe's fifth largest economy. They may look small on the map, but they're very important for Europe. So all of these different countries are having leadership problems, leadership crises, all at the same time.
Yeah, and we think of democracy as something that has been around forever, because it has been around for all our lifetime. But especially with Spain, a country like that, they have been a dictatorship not too long ago. And before that, they obviously were part of the Holy Roman Empire.
The 70s, wasn't it? Yeah. Portugal as well.
So, and they obviously were also in light with Nazi Germany. So they have close ties with Germany. And even today, they are making major military cooperations with Germany. And you can see them also saying, like, well, there's a better way forward. They see it. Democracy is not working for us. Let's revert back to different methods. And that's definitely prophesied.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make. Like, we, for both of our lifetimes, democracy has kind of been viewed as the default. And you have this view. I mean, this is Francis Fukuyama is probably the individual that articulated it most specifically. This kind of end of history idea that democracy is the default. Democracy is the final destination. Democracy and free market capitalism is how Fukuyama puts it. And that all of man's history is just leading to that. And if you're looking at just purely this narrow slice of history that goes back maybe 30, 40 years, yeah, it kind of looks like that. America, the democratic and capitalist power, won the Cold War. The Soviet Union fell. They're officially democratic. I mean, clearly Vladimir Putin is not democratically elected, but the fact that they still play lip service and they still go through the charade of democracy every 4 or 5 years and pretend to have a vote, I mean, that does say something important about the way we kind of look at democracy as being the default and the natural form of government. you take the long view and democracy is much more fragile. You go back to the 1930s and people kind of looked at democracy as the outdated, that the has-been, and that it was fascism and communism, like the new isms that were going to take over the world, and because they were scientific and modern and effective. So no, this is not, democracy is not the end of history. It is something that is very, very fragile. And we live in a world that has been dominated by Britain and the United States, and these are both democratic powers. Ultimately, these are countries that have that power because they've been blessed by God. And that's something Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong really proves thoroughly in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And because of that, we've grown up in kind of a bubble where the world is protected for democracy and freedom. And we kind of view that as then the natural, the default, as long as there's no adult, as long as there's no kind of evil people around to rock the boat, this is where everything just ends up, and it doesn't take any effort to get it there. And the reality is so very different, and it's such a fragile thing. And so it kind of seems unthinkable in some ways for us, for Europe to become undemocratic. But it should be very thinkable.
Yeah, it's also a fact that people are not naturally democratic. We all grow up in families where we don't, the children don't come around and they vote for what their parents are going to do. We all grow up, and that point has often been made, under authority to one degree or another in stable families. And then we have a government that's very different. So there's a natural struggle between democracy, and God definitely didn't decide it that way. In the Bible, there's a very clear authority. If you follow God's laws, you don't vote on God's laws. So there's a common struggle here, but there's a very dangerous road if that desire for leadership is abused.
And of course, in the Bible as well, there's a lot of individual responsibility and individual freedom. Ancient Israel was very not a big government and a big bureaucracy. You combine kind of a human-led dictatorial structure with what you have today. I mean, that was in the CDU manifesto. I think it was just published today, where they want to copy what Britain has done with security cameras everywhere. They want much more CCTV monitoring and things like that. You know, you combine all of those modern technologies with these systems, and you see them very easily abused, and people very easily getting a whole lot of power and control over individual lives. But before we get too much, I guess, down in the nature of government and that kind of thing, I do think it's worth looking at and commenting on the fact that then you do have Giorgia Meloni kind of as this island of stability. Like, you look at where are there leaders in Europe that can step forward and be the strong ones as crises happen and things like that. It's Giorgia Meloni and then maybe Donald Tusk in Poland, where Poland is increasingly becoming this major military power. And also Tusk is a Eurocrat. He served in Brussels. He kind of has a lot of connections. He knows how the system works. I mean, in a lot of ways, he's kind of almost a European or German puppet within Poland, pushed on him. But he is still secure in his position. And I think is fascinating about that is Giorgia Meloni's party is the successor, the descendant party, you could say, of Benito Mussolini's fascists. Like, they, after World War II, they rebranded because they couldn't call themselves the Fascist Party anymore. They went through, I think, two or three other rebrands, and they became Giorgia Meloni's party. And you mentioned Revelation 17 earlier. Revelation 17 tells us a whole number of things about this empire that is rising up that Antiochus is going to lead. And you can put parts of these prophecies side by side and see that they're talking about the same empire. And Revelation chapter 17 tells us that you're going to have, that it's going to be led by 10 kings that give their power to one overall leader, to this Antiochus. It also tells us that it rises and falls. It also says at some point, well, there are 7 kings, 5 are fallen, one is yet to come. And what that tells us is, well, there's a sequence. That 5 kings, at the time that this prophecy would be revealed, 5 kings are in the past, 1 king is on the scene, 1 king is yet to come. So these kings come one after another. So what we're seeing rising up in Europe is a resurrection of what we've seen before in Europe, and a continuation of what we've seen before in Europe. And the last time you had a strong empire like this that's described by Revelation 17 in Europe was World War II. And what we're having is a resurrection of what went on during World War II. And even talking specifically about that sixth resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, which is what we saw during World War II, it says in verse 8, it talks about the beast being in the bottomless pit. And what that kind of really means is it's underground. And so this empire, it goes underground, it rises back up from the underground. So it kind of goes into hiding and comes back again. And that's what Mussolini's supporters did, and a great many others. They went into hiding. Now they're coming back again. They're still probably in hiding in some ways, in that the branding is quite different, but they're back on the public scene. And I think that connection between Giorgia Meloni and her party and going back to Mussolini is fulfilled prophecy, or points back to this empire that went before. And so to see that happening, I think, is critical. And I think a lot about Giorgia Meloni kind of looks good on the surface. And it really takes that biblically revealed understanding to see what is happening here. But Mr. Flurry had an article when Giorgia Meloni was elected and talked about all of this. That article is Fascism Reawakens in Italy, if you want to go back and read that. And again, that will take you through Revelation 17 and show how it applies to Italian politics. And he wrote in there, Hitler became the sixth head of the Holy Roman Empire and Italy enabled it to happen. Will history repeat itself? He says in there, Mussolini, in that sense, paved the way for Hitler and they united and started World War II. He says in there as well, the heart of that superpower will be this coming superpower, Germany and Italy, just as it was in World War II. You can prove that from your Bible. So he asks there, just as Mussolini paved the way for Hitler, will you see Giorgia Meloni and her party in Italy pave the way for this strongman? So I do think it's fascinating that while everywhere in Europe is falling apart, the one leader that does have some strength there is Giorgia Meloni in Italy. And so will she play a key role in solving this leadership crisis by kind of facilitating this strongman coming in by flatteries?
Yeah, and one thing that Meloni did, she was aligning herself with the Catholic Church. You remember she was attending some of those conferences, and Italy is obviously mostly Catholic. And if you have someone that stands up for some of those traditions, you have someone with Meloni that looks more moderate, that doesn't look like Mussolini or Adolf Hitler, then you can really see someone like that garnering much support. And we definitely see that in Germany. In Germany, we have a party that has connections to World War II too, but they were much better in disguising that. That's the Christian Democratic Union. They formed right after, and there were many Nazis in that party, and they have those ties too, but they were much better in rebranding themselves.
And I think the other thing that's interesting to look at of Giorgia Meloni is her relationship to Donald Trump. The Telegraph had an article earlier this week where they talked about that, you know, as you have all of these tariffs and all of these points of disagreement between Europe and America and a Trump presidency, that Giorgia Meloni is kind of the person best placed to go and talk to Donald Trump about these. It talked about the close relationship she's had with Elon Musk, that both Donald Trump and Giorgia Meloni have had very nice things to say about each other. And like I said, I think there is a lot on the surface about what she's done that looks pretty good. And it does take, I think, the Bible to reveal what is going on here.
It's very interesting with that relationship. We see something similar with Emmanuel Macron, who just invited Donald Trump to Notre Dame. And the former leader of Austria, Sebastian Kurz, he also has very close ties to Donald Trump. He's like working with the Abraham Accords and with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's married to Ivanka Trump. And he's also close to Richard Grenell, that just got a pretty good position in the Trump administration, and to Peter Thiel, which is a billionaire investor of Donald Trump. So there are some very interesting connections to some European leaders that we are watching and warning about, and the Trump administration. And especially with Italy there, if Elon Musk goes over there and he looks into her eyes and all those pictures, they almost swoon over her. And it's like, this is the future of Europe, they say. And like, the future of Europe was the past of Europe. So that's interesting too.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And getting back to that past, and even the Notre Dame Cathedral and things like that, Revelation 17, another critical point here is it talks about this beast that's a type of an empire in the Bible. and it's led by a woman that calls the great whore that sits upon many waters. Verse 3 says, I saw a woman sit upon the scarlet colored beast. And a woman in biblical symbolism is a sign of a church. You know, the true church is typified as the bride of Jesus Christ, and false churches or other churches are typified as, you know, other women and as immoral women, as you have here. And you look at the history of Europe, and this really helps you identify this empire. It's risen and fallen several times, 7 times in total it will have done, and it's led by a church. And that is the Holy Roman Empire in Europe, where you have continually this empire that dominates and is led by a church. And so when you see Giorgio Meloni drawing close to the Catholic Church in an era where we see wokeness doing abominable things to children, seeing someone like Giorgio Meloni stand up for family values, just, it looks refreshing. But the Bible again warns that there's so much that appearances are deceiving about this church. You know, it says it looks like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. We've got to go beyond just what it looks like. So she's drawing closer to the Catholic Church. You're even seeing the Notre Dame Cathedral, I think, really put Europe's Catholic heritage on display. And that aspect of the Holy Roman Empire is also critical to talk about in terms of this leadership crisis. And that when you look at it, it's the woman that leads and guides the beast. We can expect the Catholic Church to play a major role as well in solving this political crisis.
Yeah, and later W. Armstrong went back and back to that prophecy because he said Europe cannot unite unless they have that guiding force. And I have a quote here from 1977, which I really like, where he says, but those nations cannot get themselves together. At the same time, the Roman Catholic Church is having the greatest crisis in its history. Well, you could say the same today. They have an even bigger crisis now. Look at its history. The time is near for a pope, probably not a present one, we could say the same today, to extend his good graces to the nations of Europe and to bring them together, but only as a union of church and state with the pope at the top, at the head, so that everyone will be forced to become Catholic within their jurisdiction, that is. So he is talking about that glue that has united the Holy Roman Empire in the past, which was a mixture of different peoples as well, but they came under one government and they came under the Pope. And that's something we are observing very closely. And the Catholic Church is in kind of a crisis. They are desperate to get out of that crisis. Politics are in a crisis. Are we going to see them come together more and more? And an interesting fact about that is the leader that we are watching, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, he has made a documentary about the crisis of the Catholic Church, and he also talks about how society needs the Catholic Church as like a unifying factor. So he is very much aware of the power. He actually called the documentary The Power of the Churches. So he's aware of that power, and he will likely use it.
And European leaders, they like to talk about Charlemagne a lot, who was a much earlier ruler of the Holy Roman Empire. And I think I've even got a commemorative 5 euro coin someone gave me recently that has like the crown of Charlemagne on there. It's something, they use that iconography all the time. And you look at the rise of Charlemagne and his father and grandfather. I mean, you kind of had a leadership crisis back then. And it was the Catholic Church that solved it. And it was the Catholic Church that took Charlemagne's family, I think it was in the days of his father, and said, no, you're not just mayors, you're not just dukes, you're not just a lord. We are going to make you king of the Franks, and then we're going to make you empire of the Romans. And they have this track record in the Holy Roman Empire of being the ones that step forwards and fix the leadership crisis. And the Catholic Church has always had a very strong focus on the European Union. And in fact, several politicians that played a major role in getting the European Union going. You know, names I think that people that are very familiar with the news will be familiar with, you know, like Schumann. I think Konrad Adenauer is even one of them. But several of these individuals are on the process of sainthood. And I think Schumann in particular is very close to being made officially a saint, which, like, you have to go all the way back to, I think it's Thomas More, Henry VIII's chancellor, to find the last politician that was treated this way by the Catholic Church. And it was 500 years ago. So they do put a lot of focus on, you know, they're very aware of what is going on in Europe, and they have been very supportive of that European project. So, you know, a new pope and a greater Catholic role, that absolutely will play a major role in what we're seeing in Europe. But I also think, you know, you quoted from Mr. Armstrong, I think that does bring, that's kind of a perfect place, I think, to conclude this show, that Revelation chapter 17 and verse 10, I mentioned this already, it says there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and another is not yet come. And this passage really confuses a lot of people, because it's kind of like, well, why does it say five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come? And this confused a lot of people as to the identity of the beast, because they thought, well, when John was on the scene, is that the five resurrections of this beast were in the past? And it's not. Instead, this is frozen in time at when this book would be revealed. God knew the outline of all of world history, the outline of all of this Holy Roman Empire. But there's also a prophecy there that during the sixth resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, God would cause this book to be revealed. And God always works through one man to do that. And so it's revelation from God, but he worked through Herbert W. Armstrong, and he wrote several books. You know, he wrote things like Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? Is just excellent for understanding who these beast powers are. And it's a really short book, and it's really simple. It is packed full of evidence. I mean, he has another book, Proof of the Bible, where you can prove that the Bible is true, and you can do that very simply and easily. Once you've done that, well, then you can very simply and easily prove who and what is the prophetic beast. And God revealed exactly when this would happen. And so we're looking at what's happening in Europe, and we're seeing all of these ingredients come together exactly the way the Bible said that you would. And you'd have all of these different aspects of this strong leader. Now, we don't have the strong leader on the scene right now, but I mean, to continue to abuse the ingredients metaphor, I think you can clearly see that cake in the process of being made. Whether it's mixed up, whether it's in the oven, I'm not sure where we are on that process, but the ingredients prophesied in your Bible are here already. You can see Bible prophecy playing out already. You can see fulfilled prophecy on this subject already. And that imposes a responsibility on you. That means, okay, well, if that is the case, if this Bible prophecy is being fulfilled, that makes this book really valuable, because it's showing you what is happening in the world. It's written by a living God who forecasts in detail events thousands and thousands of years ago. But then more than that, God says he works through specific individuals. There was a specific time that this book would be revealed. Matthew 17 and verse 10, Jesus Christ himself talked about an end time Elijah that would come before he would return, and that he would restore all things. He would restore truth to his church through that individual. So if you're seeing fulfilled prophecy, well, you need to go and you need to look at these individuals, and you need to look at what Herbert W. Armstrong taught. And then God keeps working through one man. So you need to look at, well, who succeeded Herbert W. Armstrong? Can you prove who that is? Who is God using to reveal new truths? And we've been quoting several articles by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry. And you can go and you can prove what he's been writing, and see God working through him as well. So I think all of this Bible prophecy, and we've touched on this a fair bit over the last few months. I think Philip Nice and I, we had a bit of a deeper dive on this subject when we went through the latest Trumpet print edition a few weeks ago. All of this points to God, and it points to the man God is using and the work that God is doing. And if you can see fulfilled prophecy in Europe, well, that imposes an obligation on you to take action. One of the first steps is proving this for yourself. And so, you know, we've mentioned quite a few different pieces of material, quite a few different articles as we've gone along here. The main one I'll leave you with is that most recent one from Mr. Flurry. After Trump's victory, watch Germany. We'll put a link to that in our show notes. You can get all of the different books and booklets that I have mentioned today on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to send those to you for free. We want you to not take our word for it and to prove this for yourself. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Joshua.
Thanks for having me again.
And thanks so much to George Haddad for engineering and production. We'll be back on Friday for our regular Week in Review show. And until then, keep watching your world.